Talk of our country's role on the world stage often gets to the concept of the American century, the period when the United States is the big power, the superpower, the country that is able to guide or at least influence much of what goes on in the world. If you set the clock by the origination of the phrase American century, that would be until 2041. Our guest this hour is one of many who doubts we'll get a full century. China, in particular, is making constant moves to assure a broad level of its own influence on world affairs. And, of course, we have our own issues. Alfred W. McCoy examines them in his book, In the Shadows of the American Century, subtitled The Rise and Decline of U.S. Global Power. Alfred McCoy is a professor of history at the University of Wisconsin in Madison. His writing focuses on covert operations, the Philippines, and modern empires. His first book, The Politics of Heroin in Southeast Asia, came out in 1972, despite pressure from the CIA to suppress it. So Alfred McCoy's had a long and interesting history of his own in studying history. Thanks for joining us today on the Jefferson Exchange.
Oh, thank you, Jeff, for having me on.
The details that you provide in the introduction to this book about the politics of heroin, I mean, heroin was supplied to American troops in Vietnam, and a lot of them.
Indeed. By 1971, according to a later White House survey of about 1,000 returning veterans, it's believed that about 34% of all U.S. combat forces in South Vietnam were heavy, regular users of heroin. In a word, they were heroin addicts. And if that's accurate, that meant that there were probably more heroin addicts in the U.S. Army in South Vietnam than there were in the entire United States. It was a massive epidemic. That was basically the kicker in the cocktail of the Vietnam War that devastated the U.S. Army and took a decade or more to rebuild it into an all-volunteer force.
Yeah, some fairly shocking information there. But the process that you undertook in writing The Politics of Heroin seems like you developed a mode of operation there that helped you with all your research.
Indeed. Discovering that America's allies in South Vietnam, the Commander-in-Chief of the Royal Laotian Army, top generals in the South Vietnamese Army, were involved in the production and distribution of the heroin to American troops, their allies in South Vietnam, was, of course, enormously controversial. In particular, I discovered that the Commander-in-Chief of the Royal Laotian Army, who had nearly all of his funds provided by the U.S. taxpayer, a man named General Uyên Ratacon, was running the world's largest heroin a lab, and it was producing about 100 kilos of number 4 heroin a month, and that was being supplied directly to U.S. forces. Now, in order to undercover that, what I developed was a method of going back into the French colonial past when opium was legal. It was sold by the French colonial government to the Vietnamese, and I tracked that forward step by step. And what I developed was, if you will, a knowledge of the unchanging logistics of the drug trade. So the patterns persisted, and the actors who were manipulating those patterns changed periodically. But by following that structure, I could figure out who the contemporary actors were. So in effect, it's a method by using the past, tracking historical continuity to the present, and discovering or uncovering covert aspects of U.S. foreign policy. I've since used that to study, for example, the CIA's development of torture back in the 1950s and the way it influenced the performance of U.S. troops at Abu Ghraib prison in Iraq in the last years of our war there.
So people who wouldn't tell you what they're doing now would happily tell you what their counterparts were doing 40, 50 years ago.
You can find a documentary trail much more easily in the past than you can in the present.
Mm-hmm.
When documents are declassified or simply, appear in archives, you can read those documents and you can track things forward. And moreover, the other thing I learned from that exploration of the drug trade in Vietnam was I discovered something very distinct, I think, and important about the character of U.S. global power. The single distinguishing feature that separates the U.S. hegemony, the U.S. empire, if you wish to call it that, I don't think we can, from previous empires was this covert dimension. In the aftermath of World War II, the United States created an extraordinarily powerful covert apparatus embodied in two key institutions, the Central Intelligence Agency, which tried to manipulate foreign actors abroad, and the National Security Agency, which tries to monitor, at that point they were monitoring signals, communications, microwave, radio transmissions. Now they, of course, monitor the Internet. And this gave the U.S. extraordinary capacity for surveillance and for manipulating foreign societies. And the U.S. needed this as a central aspect of its global power for a very simple reason. There is a kind of delicate duality underlying the U.S. global system, the world system the United States created after World War II. On the one hand, it was enormously idealistic. In order to assure that the world would never experience the massive death and destruction, 50 million people dying, cities across the planet ravaged, the United States came up with the idea of creating an international organization, the United Nations, a powerful organization that could actually, if you will, help administer the globe. Moreover, they created a parallel apparatus for the international economy. We held the Bretton Woods Conference in 1944 at the end of World War II. We created the World Bank, the International Monetary Fund, to manage global development and keep currents balanced and to open the world to trade, the idea being that in the 1930s, the tariff barriers had intensified the depression, destabilized societies like Germany and Italy, and created tensions that moved the world toward war. This very idealistic international governance, all grounded in the international rule of law, was paired with the grim construction of a powerful apparatus for U.S. global power that advantaged the United States. There was, therefore, a central contradiction in the U.S. international order. The U.S. came to world power at a time when six overseas European empires were coming to an end. So we went very quickly, in a space of about 10 to 15 years, from six empires to 100 new nations. And they were sovereign nations. And so the United States, in order to exercise its hegemony, had to intervene in nations that were nominally sovereign. So how can you intervene when you're not supposed to intervene? Covertly is how you do it.
Covertly.
And that gave the CIA its power.
All right, we'll pick it up on the other side of a break. In the Shadows of the American Century, the book by Alfred W. McCoy. He's our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. We'll come back and talk more with him. And you are welcome to join the conversation by phone or email when we're back on the Exchange in a minute five. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We're talking about the world today and America's place in it. And are we sliding? Alfred W. McCoy, a historian at the University of Wisconsin, thinks yes, potentially we are, particularly with as aggressive as China has gotten in trying to assert its place in the world. The book is called In the Shadows of the American Century, The Rise and Decline of U.S. Global Power. You can join the conversation on the Exchange, your thoughts on where we stand in the world, where we should stand in the world, and what would change things. 800-838-3760 to join the conversation by phone, by email. It's jx@jeffnet.org. So what you're just describing is a fairly idealistic, let's do things together as many countries set up with the United Nations and the International Monetary Fund and originally the General Agreement on Trade and Tariffs. But at the same time, this covert set of operations going on, is there a parallel in previous, and I'm going to use your term empires here, but or was it just that because they actually controlled things through colonies, they didn't need to do all those covert operations?
Yeah, I think that's correct. Also, in the high imperial age from the mid-19th to the mid-20th century, the half a dozen European nations established actual sovereignty over about half of humanity through colonies, protectorates, and the like. And so therefore, they were the administration of those countries. They had, for the most part, special branch, what the British called special branch police, red squads, if you will, that were responsible for surveilling elites and maintaining political order and controlling nationalist aspirations. But that was pretty small compared to the massive U.S. covert apparatus. No, it's that covert dimension that really distinguishes the United States. But the sort of the full panoply of American power was not unlike the British, in fact, quite similar. First of all, we had the matchless U.S. military. Just as the British Navy ruled the seas, so the U.S. Air Force ruled the skies during the American era after World War II. Moreover, the U.S. had a very powerful global navy. Second, we had like Britain in its day, through the City of London, exported billions of pounds sterling in capital. The United States was the preeminent economic power At the end of World War II, we controlled about half of gross world production. The United States also had a very aggressive and skillful diplomacy, manifest, of course, in building that international order, but also in maintaining multilateral alliances and close bilateral relations. And then there was the covert dimension, the CIA, and their primary task was basically they failed in their attempts to penetrate the Iron Curtain. If there's one thing that the Soviet and Chinese police states are good at, it's policing. And so whenever we tried to penetrate, those operations were disastrous. But the CIA proved amazingly effective in manipulating foreign societies on our side of the Iron Curtain through electoral manipulation and coups to actually change governments. And the object of CIA operations was to assure that, if you will, the subordinate elites, the presidents and prime ministers of those 100 new nations around the globe, plus the European nations, were essentially pro-American, and socialists like Salvador Allende would be eliminated from power. So, you know, in those areas, the military, diplomatic, and economic, the U.S. empire was very similar to the British. It's in the covert domain the U.S. was different. But there's also another distinguishing feature of the U.S. empire that's very, very important. It's, if you will, the foundation, the substrate of geopolitics. The United States became the first empire in the history of the world to control what we might call the axial ends of the vast Eurasian continent. Through NATO in Western Europe and then a string of bilateral alliances with Japan, South Korea, the Philippines, and Australia running down off the coast of Asia, the United States had these two anchors for control over Eurasia.
Which corresponds with a vision that Harold Mackinder came up with earlier in the 20th century. Tell us a little bit about him and his coining of the term geopolitics.
Sure. Sir Herbert Mackinder was the director of the London School of Economics, and in 1904 he gave a lecture called The Geographical Pivot of History to the Royal Geographical Society in London. And he looked at the map differently. He was, by training, a geographer. And he said that actually Europe, Asia, and Africa weren't three separate continents. When you tilted the globe and slightly towards the Arctic, what you saw instead was a unitary landmass comprising these three continents that were what he called the world island. And he said that from this perspective, the pivot region, the heartland of the world island, running from the Persian Gulf to the East Siberian Sea, right across the empty wastes of Eurasia, that, you know, he said that he who controls the heartland controls the world island, and he controls the world island controls the world. And what Sir Halford Mackinder was referring to in 1904, of course, was that that Europe and Asia had been historically considered and are still actually taught in school as separate continents. But actually, it's an anomaly. They're the only continent it's a unified landmass.
Mm-hmm.
And the only thing that made Europe and Asia two separate continents were that vast, empty center of several thousand miles of wasteland. Well, in 1904, the Trans-Siberian Railway was crawling from Moscow across Siberia to Vladivostok, and Mackinder felt that would change the nature of world power, shifting it from the seas surrounding the world island, where Britannia ruled the waves, to the inland. Well, where the rails and mines and industries would develop the vast resources of Eurasia and shift geopolitical power to the heart of Eurasia. Well, of course, World War I, World War II, the Cold War, the Sino-Soviet split, all that delayed that. But then in 2007 or thereabouts, China, even before they announced the so famous One Belt, One Road strategy, began investing. They made about $4 trillion very quickly from their incorporation of the World Trade Organization and their open access to U.S. markets. So China began investing about $1 trillion of that $4 trillion in transforming the infrastructure of Eurasia, laying down a transcontinental grid of oil and gas pipelines and rail lines to realize Sir Halford Mackinder's vision. Simultaneously, China began a sustained military buildup, and they slowly, surely began building up their presence in the Arabian Sea and in the South China Sea. And about 4 years ago, they began dredging those famous seven bases in the South China Sea. They also spent about $200 billion in transforming a sleepy Pakistani fishing village at Gwador into a modern port for the Chinese Navy. That's just 300 miles from the mouth of the Persian Gulf, where all the oil flows, and very strategic. And then they've just now, last year, got a brand new base in Djibouti at the western end of the Arabian Sea. So by building this infrastructure across the continent and slicing through the circles of steel that the United States laid down during the Cold War of jets, military bases, now drones, and three massive Navy fleets, China is hoping to displace the United States from Eurasia and destroy the geopolitical foundations for U.S. global power, creating a situation in which, as if almost by natural law, that trade, commerce, and then geopolitical power will flow through that trans-Eurasian infrastructure away from Washington and towards Beijing.
Alfred McCoy is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, a historian at the University of Wisconsin in Madison. His latest book is called In the Shadows of the American Century, The Rise and Decline of U.S. Global Power. And you're hearing right now about one of the major players in that, which is China, of course. You can join the conversation on the Exchange. Do you agree with what you're hearing here? Do you think it's all wet? Do you have some perspective of your own to share? We'd like to hear from you. 800-838-3760 by phone. Our email address is jx@jeffnet.org. Given, I mean, was the United States hoping in some sense, Alfred, that their close economic ties with China would preclude China being as aggressive as it has been? Or was there some other wishful thinking or something involved here?
Well, I think, you know, the smart money in Washington said that, well, China was going to enter the world system on our terms. We created that liberal apparatus I described of the World Trade Organization, the UN, the World Court, and all the rest, and what Washington was hoping was by opening our markets to China, letting them into the World Trade Organization, that China would enter the international community on American terms. And the first president to really realize that China wasn't just playing by our rules, they were determined, in fact, to displace the United States as the world preeminent power, was Barack Obama. And Barack Obama is, in my view, and many would disagree, one of three American geopolitical geniuses, leaders who understand the subtlety of global geopolitics, and he's only one of three in the last 120 years. Obama came up with what I regard as a very clever, if not brilliant, plan for checking China. First of all, Obama recognized the infrastructure that China's laying down across Eurasia and the threat that it represented for U.S. trade. And so he developed two trade pacts, the Trans-Pacific Partnership and the Transatlantic Trade and Investment Partnership, TTP and TTIP. And these two trade agreements would have redirected 60% of all world trade away from China, draining the Eurasian continent, shifting Asian trade across the Pacific towards the United States via sea, and shifting the European end of that trade across the Atlantic towards the United States.
Well, I want to make it clear here because we get a fair number of people who really don't like the TPP, and I feel like it needs to be pointed out a lot. This is not an agreement with China. This is an agreement around China.
Oh, yes, by all means. China was excluded from it. It was 12 nations surrounding China, but specifically excluding China, designed to check China, okay? China has its own international agreement, now that President Trump, during his first week of office, voided the TTP. China has a regional cooperation pact of 16 nations, and there were many progressives in the United States, labor unions, environmental activists, labor activists, that fought the TTP, felt that, first of all, the secrecy of its negotiation, the fact that senators like Elizabeth Warren, in order to read it, had to go to a secure room in the U.S. Capitol. It wasn't openly and publicly debated, that it created an arbitration procedure that arguably could have superseded the U.S. court system, not a good thing. There were many reprehensible aspects, many retrogressive aspects of the TTP. But when you compare it to what's now apparently its successor, China's Regional Cooperation Agreement of 16 nations, it's far more progressive. The TTP, in fact, had protections for the environment. It did have some protections for labor. It had patent protections and the like. The Chinese agreement has none of that stuff. So in many effects, progressives in their attempt to build a better world, unfortunately, probably led to the exact opposite of what they wanted.
Let's take a call here. We have Joe in Medford on the line. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange. We're talking to Alfred McCoy about his book, In the Shadows of the American Century. Hi, Joe.
Hi. Much of what your guest is saying, it sounds very logical and correct, but I wanted to question or maybe clarify some of the earlier statements. Is it true that he said that, well, two things. One, that the U.S. or France was supplying opium to the Vietnamese?
Now, let me answer that question very quickly. The French, like most European colonies in Southeast Asia, had official opium monopolies. That's to say that the government had a monopoly, kind of like New Hampshire has a monopoly on the sale of liquor within the state of New Hampshire, and I think Virginia has the same. Alcohol beverage controls are usually called. Well, the French had the same thing for opium. So they imported the opium. They had a factory that turned the raw opium from India into refined opium. They had about 3,000 opium shops and opium dens that were registered, and those retail outlets counted at peak for about 20% of all the tax revenues for French Indochina. The highest was British Malaya, where opium accounted for over 50% of all tax revenues for the British in Malaya. Now, in 1951, the UN began a process of restricting the legal sale of opium internationally, picking up from the work of the League of Nations, and so the French government began the process of prohibiting it. But up to that point, the French colonial government had sold opium as a major source of revenue.
Right.
Yep, that's correct.
Good. So my second point's more important, but I wanted to point out that when I was in Vietnam in the infantry, I was part of a company that was in large part all draftees, so most of us were really not into the war, more self-preservation. But when I was there, there was paregoric opium available at pharmacies, but I think it was also available here at some point in our history to use for infants when we were cutting teeth and so forth. But my the other point is more important, that I believe you stated that 34% of the U.S. Military were on heroin to some extent?
In 1971. What year were you in Vietnam?
68, 69.
Yeah, that was a period in which marijuana was fairly prevalent in the ranks. And in 69, the U.S. Army decided to crack down on marijuana. And they ordered staff sergeants and officers in, you know, encampments and combat companies across the country to make sure soldiers didn't smoke. And because, as we all know, marijuana has a very distinctive smell, that suppression was very effective. And what that did is that created a market opening for heroin. And so seven paramilitary organizations, most of which were fighting for the CIA in the Golden Triangle region where Burma, Thailand, and Laos converge, they opened heroin labs in the Golden Triangle region and began shipping the drugs down to South Vietnam. So that by 1970, the heroin abuse among U.S. soldiers was proliferating. And I know veterans, one guy who was just in my course in the Vietnam Wars, he was in Westmoreland staff. He was a non-commissioned officer working on the staff. He said that when he was there in 1969, the company was clean, but his buddies who were still there in 70 and 71 said that even in the barracks for Westmoreland staff, he said those little vials that GIs use to smoke heroin, he said they're just in the toilets, under the bunks, all over the place. Everybody, he said, even in West, at that point it would have been General Abrams' staff, were using heroin. It was just out of control.
Joe, thanks for the call. Appreciate you seeking that clarification. As we talk about the things that have weakened the United States, the Vietnam War being one of them, there are ways in which we have certainly made some changes to sort of keep up. And as you bring the book into the 21st century, you give us an idea of the vast array of internet and tech and military power that we've managed to put to work.
Yeah, one of the key attributes of U.S. global power has been the so-called military-industrial complex. President Eisenhower, in his very famous speech when he was leaving office, talked about that military industrial complex, and he said that because of the Cold War, we are not in a position anymore of ramping up our science and technology when conflict breaks up. He said we've created a permanent union of science and industry under the Defense Department to produce the modern, sophisticated weapons and technology we need for our military power. And that's correct. The Pentagon, through its defense contractors, who are more or less on sort of permanent contracts from one product to another, have developed this very resilient research capacity that's enshrined or housed in the DARPA, the Defense Advanced Projects Administration. And they have a genius of turning every U.S. military defeat into a testing ground for the production of new weaponry. And we can talk about some of those advances when we come back after break.
You're handling the hosting chores well, Alfred. Thanks for that. The book is called In the Shadows of the American Century, The Rise and Decline of U.S. Global Power. Becca in Lane County writes, this is fascinating to hear some solid history and facts behind a topic that many of us have been talking about for a while. Thanks for that, Becca. More phone calls and emails and more Alfred McCoy when we return to the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 10. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We're talking about the world and America's role in it. We have been the lone superpower in some people's eyes for a long time now, in part of what was once coined the American century. And Alfred McCoy at the University of Wisconsin, a historian there, isn't so sure we're going to make it to 100 years. His book is called In the Shadows of the American Century, The Rise and Decline of U.S. Global Power. It tracks what we have done, but also what China is doing now and how we're responding. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange. Your thoughts, your questions, your comments, 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. We're just talking about the sort of permanent merging, as Eisenhower saw it, of technology and the military, and that has gone on unabated since his time, hasn't it?
Indeed. Let's take Vietnam, which most people recognize was a searing defeat for the United States. Most accounts of the war talk about the infantry combat, the incredibly difficult combat conditions for American troops that basically ravaged the U.S. Army. What most people are not aware of course, there was another war that was even larger than the ground war. That was the air war. The Vietnam War was and remains the biggest air war in military history. The United States conducted more operations over Indochina during the 10 years of the Vietnam War than it had in all of World War II. We dropped the same tonnage on tiny Laos, 2,100,000 tons of bombs, that we dropped on Germany and Japan in the whole of World War II. So this gave the U.S. Air Force ample grounds for experimentation. And one of the chief experiments was the McNamara Line. McNamara recognized that the infiltration of manpower material down the Ho Chi Minh Trail from North Vietnam to South Vietnam to supply both North Vietnamese forces and the Viet Cong guerrillas was undercutting the U.S. capacity to win the war. And he looked at the possibility of building a hard line of barbed wire fences and searchlights and 140,000 soldiers, realized that that was simply not feasible. So what he came up with was a bold idea of an electronic battlefield. And the U.S. Air Force dropped 20,000 sensors, acoustic, seismic, heat, and ammonia sensors, in the Ho Chi Minh Trail, an area about 50, 60 miles wide and about 200 miles long in southern Laos. And then constantly circling above these sensors were EC-121 communication aircraft, the turboprops that have the big dishes on the top.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And those then transmitted all of those, that countless millions of electronic blips, to a 20,000-square-foot concrete bunker across the Mekong River at a U.S. base in Thailand. Some of the biggest IBM computers in the world with the first visual display units, because in those days all output from computers was dot matrix printers. And IBM just developed the visual display unit, i.e. the computer screen. And so on that computer screen, all that data produced something called a worm, a moving line supposedly representing a North Vietnamese truck convoy. The computer would transmit signals to a U.S. aircraft that would take off, and then the computer would unleash the bombs at the point where the worm was. And this was an incredibly bold experiment in electronic battlefield. It meant that a U.S. pilot was not actually seeing the target. Okay, it was all being done computerized. All right. The other thing the United States did, and nobody recognizes it, it developed drones. The United States transformed the dumb Firebee target drone into a reasonably agile long-distance drone capable of flying 2,500 miles over China or North Vietnam, collecting intelligence. And that's the basis of the modern drone technology. The military drone came out of Vietnam. And that's just an example of how the Pentagon, through this kind of inbuilt engineering and through its research apparatus and its nexus of defense contractors, can transform every single military defeat into a new technology. And we've done the same in Iraq and Afghanistan. I mean, out of that has come two things. One, the cyber warfare, the digital surveillance, which is extremely sophisticated and is now basically pervasive worldwide and across the United States. And then the other thing that the United States has created is also the full weaponization of the skies above us. The drone, a very sophisticated drone technology. We've since built 60 drone bases stretching from Sicily to Guam to maintain our control over Eurasia. And we're beginning now the weaponization of space so that when conflict comes, if conflict does come with China, I expect that the premier battleground will be satellites from about 100 to 500 miles orbiting around the Earth.
So it does surprise you then that there have been no major agreements on the regulation of armaments in space and not much apparently about the use of drones. I mean, the fact is we use them in other countries. There's no reason other countries wouldn't decide, hey, we can use them there.
Yeah, this is one thing I point out in my book that most people aren't aware of. There are very elaborate diplomatic protocols for land boundaries, right? I mean, President Trump wants to build a wall, okay? Mm-hmm. I mean, showing this invisible line on the map is the most powerful line on the planet. Armies in their steel treads will stop at that line. We've now, through the UN Convention of the Law of the Sea, we've established very precise laws for maritime territory. The one aspect of the Earth that remains completely unregulated is the sky above us. How high is the sovereignty of the United States? How much of the air above us or the space above us do we control? Well, the two international conventions, the failed Paris Convention of 1910 and the Chicago Convention of 1949, which regulates all air travel and supposedly, controls the sky above us, avoided any discussion of that point. It simply refers to the air above. It doesn't say, where does the air end? Maybe we move from the sky to the stratosphere to the exosphere. Where is sovereignty? Well, the simple fact of the matter is that in the modern world, this is a Darwinian domain. You have as much sovereign airspace as you can control and no more. And that's why this is an unregulated area and likely to be a future area of geopolitical conflict. The Pentagon in the 1960s, as a part of that engineering apparatus, built the world's first telecommunications satellite system. And since 1967, the United States has been the only power in the world that's had a comprehensive telecommunications satellite system. And we began migrating all of our what's called the three C's, command, control, and communication, for the Air Force, the Army, and the Navy. All of it migrated to these satellites. What's the difference between a hobbyist airplane or a drone you can buy and fly in your backyard and a military drone? Well, one answer, satellites. If you want to fly beyond the horizon, you've got to have satellite communication. The U.S. has got the only global system of satellites, therefore we have the only global system of drones. Well, in 2020, China's going to have be the second power in the world to have a comprehensive system of satellites. In 2007, China shocked the Pentagon by actually firing a missile and shooting down one of its own satellite orbiting in the high stratosphere.
Oh, right. Mm-hmm.
And that meant that suddenly, you know, space was contested. The U.S. military very quickly replicated that feat. We've shot down one of our own satellites. China has now, I think, gotten the edge on us technologically. They've announced that they are developing what's called photon communication between ground stations and satellites. Photons are basically light waves mm-hmm. that are transmitted and received by a unique physical receptor, so they can't be hacked at all. But microwaves are very open to being hacked, and we saw this a few years ago when Iran captured one of the CIA's most sophisticated drones, the RQ-180 drone. They basically hacked into the GPS of the drone as it was flying over Iranian airspace, and then they took control of it, and they walked it down, and they landed in Iran, and they displayed it in Tehran. Now, Iran is not the world's most sophisticated technological power, but that shows the weakness of the whole U.S. satellite system to hacking. And China has, if the reports are correct, now has a technological edge on us. One more indication that the U.S. global dominion is coming to an end. There are signs in the economic realm, the diplomatic realm, and now the technological.
So we have about 5 minutes left. I want to take some calls in here. Let's go to Paul in Grass Pass because he speaks to the economic part. Welcome, Paul.
Good morning. Yes, I honestly, it seems to me that China and any other nation state is going to surpass us economically. The military and technological components are certainly there. And I have an observation, and that is that the American century was essentially the oil century as far as that goes. And now we're moving on to other technologies, and China has definitely apparently stolen a march on us. The question that I have is if you would, address the economic pieces, including the fact that the Chinese hold most of our paper. Are we going to go down the way of the Spanish with the collapse of their empire, or are we going to be more like, I'm calling for speculation, more like the British mm-hmm. and the collapse of the empire between World War I and World War II?
All right. Thanks for that, Paul. Appreciate it.
Sure. First of all, the economic aspect and then the possibilities of collapse. The signs of U.S. economic decline are many, relative and absolute. In 1960, the United States had 40% of gross world product, 40% of the global economy. Now we're down to a little above 20%. And if you use what's called purchasing power parity, which essentially measures the real value of goods and services in the country, we have maybe 15% of the global economy. So going from 40 to 15%, that means just our raw economic power is diminished. Second of all, there's every index within a decade, China is going to surpass us in absolute terms. Furthermore, in terms of world trade, the cancellation of the Trans-Pacific Partnership, the renegotiation of NAFTA, the White House attack on the South Korean trade agreement. We're in an era of global trade, and damaging both bilateral and multilateral agreements is going to diminish U.S. leadership in the global economy. There's also critical aspect of economics, of course, is the technology, the patents that give us new products, new goods and services that we can sell. And much of the strength of the U.S. economic regime has been these multinational corporations that have goods and services that they sell transnationally. Well, let's just take the realm of patents, okay? In 2014, China, for the first time, became the number one country in the world in worldwide patent registration. They registered over half the world's patents, about 800,000, compared to just 285,000 for Americans. One of the critical areas of technology, of course, is supercomputing, which is critical for code breaking, which is central to all cyber warfare and cybersecurity, and also for consumer products. Supercomputing is becoming central right across the spectrum from military to commercial. Well, for the past 6 years, China has had the world's fastest supercomputers. Last year, they got the world's fastest supercomputer in the way that really matters, with chips made in China. They now have more supercomputers than the United States. And there are other indices as well. The U.S. education system is in a state of decline. In the international tests administered by the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, the Rich Countries Club, in 2015 tests, the United States placed 39th in math. The Chinese are usually placing around 1, 2, or 3. You can't become the world or maintain the world's top technology with an abysmal education system in which your students are testing 39th in math. I mean, maybe 4th or 39th. I mean, that's amazing that we've fallen so low. The economic picture, both in terms of gross dollars and in terms of cutting at technology, and moreover the production of a new generation of young Americans who in a few years are going to be our scientists and engineers, all of the trends look bad for the United States and fairly good for China.
And that is a pretty good summation of the general thrust of the book, In the Shadows of the American Century, The Rise and Decline of U.S. Global Power. It is very heavy on the detail, but a fairly easy read despite that. Alfred McCoy is its author from the University of Wisconsin in Madison. Thanks so much for joining us today.